Hi, so glad you found us. We're here to share the regenerative agriculture system, the know-how to implement it, and to be a virtual space for building community here on planet Earth. Today, Rick Clark, a fifth-generation farmer from Indiana, shares his main goal on the farm: building soil health. These regen basics work everywhere, and with help from experienced farmers like Rick, all farmland can customize these methods and move toward a natural balance, which translates to a healthier world and to a healthier us. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for Cultivated Audio for April 2026. Grab your earbuds and/or a shovel and let's dig in. Well, Rick, it's pretty amazing to be a fifth generation farmer. So maybe we can start by hearing about your farm in Warren County, Indiana.
Sure. Sure thing. I truly believe that my ancestors would be smiling at the direction we've taken the farm. So let me give you a little history. We were some of the best tillers in the community. We tilled and tilled and tilled, and we turned everything as black as we could turn it. And then we went into the winter totally naked, so to speak. Erosion, wind, water, snow, all of that was taking place on the farm. And it was one day in, I think it was 07, we had a 1-inch rain event. And I was driving by a field that was 1% slope, so almost flat. And the soil, well, then it wasn't soil, it was dirt. The dirt had washed from the field into the ditch and onto the road, and that's when I realized we have to do something different. This is not sustainable. That's the trigger that got this all started.
You farm quite a few acres, don't you?
Yeah, we farm several thousand acres, yeah. So you would consider us to what they say, scale. We're farming to scale. A lot of the things we do are kind of radical. We care deeply about building human health, and we care deeply about building soil health.
I read somewhere that you have a 5-crop system. What 5 crops or what crops do
nine.
You grow?
We're up to 9, I believe. Corn, soybeans, wheat, alfalfa, peas, milo, buckwheat, cover crops, sheep, and cattle.
So before we get into some of the cropping and how all of that works, I've seen that you credit your father with teaching you skills that made your 10-plus years of transitioning from conventional to regenerative possible.
Mm-hmm.
How so? And did he get behind the switch from the get-go?
Yeah, that's a great question. What Dad taught me how to think, and he taught me how to be proactive instead of reactive. And that is a huge plus, because when you are in this world of a very few limited players, you have to be able to move and react and change and do all this on the fly. A lot of it's on the fly because you're in uncharted territory. I mean, a lot of times it's been described as we're building the bridge as we cross the river. So it's kind of that immediate. And, you know, he was totally on board.
He
gave me just enough rope to hang myself. And that's what you need, because it's easy to reel yourself back in. And you cannot let yourself get too far off the deep end here to where the livelihood of the farm is being jeopardized. So he was a great mentor to me. Now he did not teach me anything about the processes we're doing now.
Right.
But he taught me how to think through them. And that's a big deal. That's a big, big bonus to have.
Absolutely, especially because when you look at the word mistake, you can think of it in the usual definition, but there's so much learning that goes on there that it can oftentimes be fortunate.
And that teaching and training then has transcended down through me, and so now that's what I try to do. You know, hey, it's okay. Don't worry about this. It's not quite what we expected, but stick it out. It's going to be fine. And I'm trying to also tell the audience, whoever that may be, that it's okay to change. change is good. We have to understand, though, that when we decide to make a change, it's got to be something that's going to work that first time. Because if it doesn't, I've seen too many people just say, I'm done. I told you this wouldn't work, and I'm never coming back. So yes. We got to be careful.
Yeah. Well, I know you consult all over the place, and soils and geography can be quite different environments to work in. But could you start with how you approached working with your soil and diversity, and then we can move into how you can translate it into a more universal project?
Yeah, it's all about the six principles of soil health. And if you don't know what those are, please Google them, the six principles of soil health. Please Google those, go through them, learn them. Minimize disturbance, diversity, living root, armor, context, and livestock. And when you decide to become a true believer and a true follower of these principles, they can be applied anywhere in the world. And the context is so important here. For this conversation, unless you want to go somewhere else, I want to stay in the United States.
Okay.
The United States, in my opinion, needs to be regionalized. And I think it needs to be in 9 regions. There needs to be an ambassador for each region. And then that ambassador is fully competent in the principles and how they are applied in their context, their region of the United States, and how are we going to maximize profitability by implementing these principles. And then underneath this ambassador are the teachers, and the teachers then are going out and teaching the farmers how to implement the principles.
Right. So, that's a wonderful idea.
You know, Robin, I think one of the issues that we have right now, and what I mean by this, the issues with the regenerative movement, or even MAHA, if you want to look at that as well, is we tend to look at things all or nothing. And I don't think that's the proper way to do this, meaning we've got to get every acre to switch or this is not going to be successful. I don't agree with that. I think if you would sit down and look at the numbers as far as savings of inputs, savings of nitrogen and phosphorus being poured onto this planet, the savings and the reduction of those inputs being put into our water systems, if we would just do the math on what 30% of a reduction would look like, it would be huge.
I know. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, which you are already doing, but in Regen Ag, yield is not the driver. Those things you just talked about is the driver. And I was just thinking earlier about knowing yield isn't the driver. And if you're standing in front of an audience saying that, you've got to have a very quick comeback before they all go out for coffee and don't come back again.
Because yeah, that's right.
My dad was an apple farmer, and in 1970, I would say, oh, Dad, let's go organic. And he was caught up in that mentality of you can't get the yield. That was the myth that went on back then. Those things you brought up, are there other things that come forward in that discussion?
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
I'll tell you, I don't think people understand the importance of health until here's when they really understand the importance of health is when they don't have it anymore.
Yes.
But when you get to that point, it's not always too late, but you've done some serious damage.
Yes.
So what we do on the farm is we look at human health in two aspects. One aspect is raising or growing a higher nutrient-dense product, whatever that is, whether it's meat or grains or whatever. And when you raise a higher nutrient-dense product, then the consumer of that product, whether it be human or an animal, greatly benefit, and then whatever they have to offer becomes at a higher value. That's one way to look at human health. The second way to look at human health is the health of the people and the health of the farmer with the chemicals that are being sprayed on the products that they eat and consume.
Of course.
And then also you've got to look at the farmer. Can you imagine the type of environment the farmer has been forced into dealing with? A lot of these products that we're using have a skull and crossbones on them. That's death.
Yes,
and,
I know.
And the system is assuming that we can continue to live in this manner and farm in this manner and be somewhat sustainable. I mean, I don't see it. So we look at this way different than most people do. I have a one-liner. I have a lot of one-liners, but one of my one-liners is, do we sacrifice yield to maintain soil health and human health? You better believe it. We do it every single day.
Pays
That's
off.
The mindset, though, that you have to get to.
Right. And it's funny for me, Rick, because folks who are on board are the ones I'm talking to every month on Cultivated
right.
Audio. So I feel like, oh, we're preaching to the choir, but given the statistics, we're not really, it's not a full-blown choir yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You spoke about soil and diversity, and if you're talking nutrient density, this is where we start.
That's true. I'm not the type of person that puts down any type of farming system. I just think that we all need to look at change.
Yes, and we can do it better.
We've been trying for a long time to do this organic with no tillage, and I'm telling you, this is hard.
Mm.
It's very hard to be a purist. And I'm going to be honest with you, and I've been honest with everyone I talk to, we have implemented some tillage into our system now, trying to figure out is strategic tillage beneficial, not only beneficial, but how detrimental is it to the system?
Okay, so what have you found?
So we're doing some testing. We're finding that, yes, there is a decrease in the microbial biome at the beginning of this tillage event. But within days or weeks, the system has bounced back, and the microbial counts are the same in most cases, and in some cases, they're even higher.
Mm.
Robin, this is where I am now on this. We've been on this journey a long time, and we have to keep our foot on the gas for this regenerative movement. But the consumer, the bureaucratic system, they're all at a point now where they're saying, okay, you know what? We've been hearing this word regenerative for several years now. It's time to stand up and prove that this truly is a system that's going to feed the masses and it's going to be a healthier way to go. When we look at our system, as radical as it is, we haven't applied any synthetic fertilizer in 12 years on our farm. No chemicals, no fertilizers, none of that stuff has been applied in over 12 years.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, do we have fields that turn into absolute disasters? Yes, we do. We sure do. Do we have fields that turn into, wow, look what we can do here? Yes, we have it all. We go from one end of the spectrum to the other. Is this type of farming today going to move the masses? No way, because it's not stable enough. But once we build a system, obviously the goal is to be heading towards zero inputs. But can we dismiss someone who's only willing today to do 20% reduction? No, we cannot. They are just as important as someone who's trying to do 80% reduction. We have to start building systems with that mindset.
Right, to head towards zero.
The mindset today is, you know what, prices are low, inputs are high, the only way I'm going to get out of this is to raise more bushels.
Right.
That's the mindset today of the conventional farmer. In their mind, they have to raise more bushels to dig themselves out of the hole they're in. And that raising more bushels comes at a cost because they are increasing inputs. They are decreasing the aspect of being a good steward. They're not doing anything that is conservation-minded. And so all of this in the end game is one step forward, three steps backwards type mentality.
And so thank you. People like yourself are getting out there and sharing the information that can make the knowledge more available and also the possibilities. And things are changing, not as quickly as
That's right.
all of us would
That's
like
right.
them to, but they are changing. And Gosh, there was a question I wanted to ask you about when you said after you tilled, the life form did come back after a week or something like that. So does that mean that you wait until you actually plant that field? Does that make a difference?
We've done it a couple different ways now. First of all, you cannot do anything better to your soil than having a living root growing as many days as possible, okay? So now, with that being said, we come in with a tillage event and we wipe out that living root.
Yes.
But we are immediately planting something behind that tillage event to start that living root again. And what we're seeing is unbelievable. For example, we did some testing in a field. We left some of the field no-till, like we always do, and we left some of the field with some tillage in it, and we can compare the two. I mean, you have to constantly be testing, and you got to be baselining your farm, and you have no idea where you're headed unless you know where you've been.
Right, you're a data guy.
yeah. And I'm just going to use arbitrary numbers here, okay, just for a simplicity of understanding. When you look at the cover crop that was planted in the no-till, and this was all done in the same day. It wasn't like these were days apart. This was the same day event. The cover crop that was planted into the lightly tilled, and when I say lightly, I mean 2 inches or less of depth. When the cover crop was planted into that environment compared to the no-till environment right next to it, the seeds came out of the ground a day and a half sooner. The amount of biomass we got at the peak of that growing season that was left was a third to 45 to 50% more than what was in the no-till. Now, did the no-till still grow a cover crop and did it look good? Yes. But the amount of foliar coverage that we had, which are the solar panels that are pulling in the sun to create the photosynthesis, which is pumping oxygen and sugar into the soil profile. That's what it's all about.
Yes.
So when you increase that by 30, 40, 50%, now you start to look at, okay, let's score that tillage event as a 4. And now let's score the cover crop that grew behind that tillage event as an 8. Aren't we up plus 4? That is the mentality of how I look at it. Now, do I want to become a tiller every day? No, that's not what I want to do. But we have to learn. One of my mottos is change is good. So we've got to change. We have to change. Always. We are going to be constantly looking at tillage and how detrimental is it to the system? How much resilience does your system have to bounce back? And at the end of the day, yes, we may have stepped back one step, but did we go forward 2 or 3? That's what matters.
Right. So if you are tilling, instead of doing it perhaps every crop rotation or every time you're getting ready to use that field again, would you maybe not do it every time? Or
right. Yeah. Right. I'm hoping every 3rd or 4th year.
Okay. Hoping that some of this specific information can really translate universally, I wanted to talk a little bit about how you are doing crop rotation and how often you're leaving a field to rest. When you're doing crop rotation, have you found if we do corn this year, then absolutely alfalfa is the best thing to follow that with? How does the actual crop fit in with the sequence of rotation? And
right.
Then the other thing is, does one crop require or ask for a longer rest period than another crop?
Yeah, those are good questions. I don't really have a set rotation pattern. I mean, I have an idea of what I want to do. And let me explain that. A lot of times the rotation is due to someone reaching out and wanting to know if we could raise a crop for them. So then I have to plan, depending on when this phone call comes, how quickly I can change the system to accept what it is they're looking for, like maybe Milo going to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would think from Indiana to Texas is absurd, but when you have organizations that need a product, they know who we are, they know the product is high quality, then transportation or logistics, they're not concerned about, because they want the product. They need the product.
Right.
So with that being said, what I really like to do is have alfalfa followed by corn. I want corn in the alfalfa when we're done with it. Okay, now let me back up just a little bit. Let's talk about nutrient removal. Some of the worst nutrient removal is from alfalfa fields. In Indiana, we are able to mow and merge and take that alfalfa crop off 5 times a year. We are removing extremely large amounts of nutrients and minerals. So this is the part of the farm that has to have manure from animals, because we cannot maintain pulling those kind of nutrients off of those fields at that level and not expect it to crash. So those are some of the only fields that we put manure back on. Okay, I just want to get that out there right now.
Yes, thank you.
Now, when we're in this rotation, it's going to be alfalfa, I hope 3 years max. It just depends. And then we're going to go into corn. Then we're probably going to go into soybeans. And then we'll go into wheat. And then from wheat, it becomes interesting. You can do a lot of things now, because the wheat's going to come off in the summertime. So now it would, logic would tell you that you need to go to corn next, because corn is the hardest crop to get a cover crop established for it when you live in a cold environment like we do. So you need a lot of time in the late summer to get your cover crop to grow for next year's corn crop. Mm-hmm. So that's what a rotation would more than likely look like. So alfalfa, corn, soybeans, wheat, back to corn, or you could go get prepared for a milo crop, or we could do a buckwheat crop, or we could set it up for grazing for the following year. Now, we don't graze near as much as we used to. We don't have the cattle numbers anymore. I culled the herd very hard 2 years ago, and unfortunately, we didn't rebuild. Now the cattle are sky high. So we are just focusing on being row crop farmers right now. And then I do want to address one of the things you mentioned, a laying off, and what I call that is called a regen year. And typically when we take a field to regen, it is because it is out of step with the rest of the farm, meaning it's been one of the last fields planted, it's one of the last fields harvested, it's too cold now to get a cover crop established, you can never go to corn in that situation. So when you get into that point where a field gets so far behind, now we go into regen. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with a cool season cocktail, and then we'll go to a warm season cocktail next summer, and then we'll go to a cocktail that we want for the following crop, which will be corn, as I explained why previously. Yes. Now, people are going to look at that and say, well, Rick, how can you take an acre out of production? You're not making any money. Well, yes, you are. You're building soil health. You're building aggregate stability, you're creating diversity, you're building water holding capacity, you're building water infiltration rates. All of these things are positive toward the next crop you're going to raise. And more than likely, whatever crop you put in this following the regen year, which more than likely is going to be corn, but more than likely that field will be your highest yielding corn field on the whole farm when you compare it to the other cornfields.
Nice.
So it's not a zero. Again, it's back to that mentality of all or nothing. It's not like that. You are gaining a lot of value. Is it monetary value in your pocketbook in the year you do it? Probably not. But it will save you huge amounts in the next crops to come.
I'm sure you can, at that point, just imagine back to where you saw a bunch of your farm on the road after that inch of rain, right?
Or blowing, and the snow turns black.
Yeah, it's just mind-blowing, literally, isn't it? When you just drive through the country and see empty, barren fields, and we should get the sheriff out giving tickets.
I believe Mr. Einstein had a... had a definition of insanity.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe it was doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting a different result.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where we are.
Mm-hmm. But things are changing little by little, perhaps, but definitely it's a turnaround. And
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. But we have to make sure, you know, the patience wears thin, and people want results now.
Right.
So we have to make sure that we keep our foot on the gas here.
Yes. So with that foot on the gas, you spoke about 9 specific regions in the U.S. How can you make a kind of a universal assistance in transition for these soils?
Yeah, I want to tell you right now, the farmers and ranchers that impress me the most are the folks that are in arid environments that get 6 inches of rain a year and have figured out how to graze livestock. They figured out how to raise row crops. I mean, these people, they're heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you move into those fragile environments, what we do in the Midwest will not work. So you have to come up with different species of cover crops.
Right.
And not only different species, but you got to come up with different rates. For example, if I created a cocktail that was to be put on at 50 pounds to the acre in Indiana, that would not fly in western Kansas, eastern Colorado. That would not fly. So you have to come up with different species at different amounts, meaning that 50 probably becomes 25 pounds to the acre. So you've got to cut every one of your species back. You got to get a wide variety of roots, deep roots, shallow roots, fibrous roots, tap roots.
And that would accommodate for the rain, right?
Yes, yes. So what happens is you slowly move yourself into what's quorum sensing. And that was discovered by Dr. Christine Jones from Australia. And if you don't know who that is, Google her. You can spend all month on her. She's fascinating.
Yes.
And when you get to the quorum sensing, then all of these species are working together in that arid environment to survive versus a one-on-one monocrop will more than likely fail. So it becomes the greater sum of the pieces is greater than the sum of the whole. And that's where you have to get to. So it's things like that. It's different species, different amounts. We have to probably look at some different cash crops. I mean, is it wise to try to raise corn in an environment that gets 6 inches of rain a year? Probably not. So we need to be looking at other crops that require less moisture intake.
Yes, understood. Now, in your teaching, is there one question that gets asked the most?
Probably one of the main questions is, this won't work here, why do you think it will? And we have to go through that scenario, which is fine, I'm okay with that. That's probably number one. And I think probably number two, and this may be number one also, I think people are wondering, why is some guy from Indiana here to talk to us about farming in Utah?
Mm, you know? Understood, yes.
What's the parallel here? Why am I here? And that's what's so beautiful about the message is I'm like, hey, you know, so-and-so executive director of this conference, they did not ask me to come to this conference to tell you how to farm. They asked me to come to this conference to show you how we do it in Indiana and take one or two of my ideas and take them home and put them to practice on your farm. And that's what it's all about. The last place I spoke at, Robin, I asked the audience, how many people in the room raised soybeans? Not one hand went up. How many people in the room raised corn? One hand went up out of 300 people. But yet, the message at the end of the day is like, wow, I get it. I understand.
As you mentioned, the universality of it with regenerative agriculture is certainly standing front and center. I've seen that you endorse 3 core elements for success. And knowing that this could lean into a universality, could you give an example of each? I know keep things simple and Don't get in over your head and do all you can with what you know.
Again, I've heard all the excuses. So you have to learn how to take those excuses away. So, and let's just, again, let's make this real simple. I'm in the Midwest speaking tomorrow, and it's going to be a bunch of row crop farmers that are raising corn and soybeans. In my opinion, every soybean raised in this United States should be raised in conjunction with cereal rye. This is easy. This one's easy. Those two like each other. There is an allelopathic release from the cereal rye plant that is detrimental to most neighbors that try to grow around it or within it, meaning weeds have a tough time to grow in cereal rye because of their allelopathic effect. But I think it's also the sequestration power of the cereal rye. It can pull nutrients deep from within the profile, laterally within the profile, and they are tremendous sequesters. So a lot of those nutrients that young plant needs are not available because they have it tied up. Now, corn is another thing. Everybody always says you can't plant corn in the cereal rye. Well, yes, you can. Mm. But you just have to understand what's going on. The rye is sequestering the nitrogen the corn needs. So once you understand that, and if you're in that position where you can still add synthetic nitrogen, then you need to add synthetic nitrogen at the front end of the corn planting process. Now, all of these things can be done. So once you teach somebody these things, and once they understand, wow, this is nothing as complex as I thought it was going to be.
Mm, yes.
And you know what, Robin? You know what I've never had one person say to me ever that we've consulted or helped? There's one thing they've never said to me is they've never told me they're going to stop doing this and not do it anymore. But you know what almost all of them have said to me? Why didn't we do this 10 years ago?
Right.
And we also got to understand here, this farming, I'm going to call it traditional farming. That means the tillage, the chemistry, the fertilizer, all that. That's what I mean by conventional farming, okay?
Yes.
When you look at a conventional farmer, that is their heritage. They've been taught by their father. They've been taught by their grandfather. And the last thing we can do is walk in there and tick everybody off, because that's not going to fly. Human nature, if you push against me, what am I going to do? What's my human nature to do? Push back. You have to show them that this is going to work. That's why we have to go small, take heed to this situation. Yes, you know what? In 5 years, you're going to look back and think, why in the world did I think this was so difficult? Because it's not. But that's not where you are. You are right here in the moment of doing something that is exactly the opposite of what you're used to doing. Yeah. So we have to make that environment friendly and easy and profitable. I believe there's a lot of farmers that don't understand biology. And I don't think they understand the importance of what that biology is doing for your potential yield. And when I look back at what we did, not having a biological program running parallel with our regenerative farming practices was a big mistake. That's the biggest mistake I've made through the years. But that's okay. I made that mistake. I preach about making that mistake so the next person won't make that mistake. So what I'm getting at here is this. When you think about a soil system that's high fertility, high chemistry, high tillage, all of that equals one word, death. That's what all that equals. And when you are constantly killing your microbial biome, and then you decide and start switching and transitioning to regenerative, you have no microbial biome there to bring you along. So that's why you need to go out, find a company you trust, and believe me, everything we do today, everything, I don't care what it is, you have to vet everything. Emails you get, people that phone call you, people that want to sell you something, you have to vet everything. And when you vet that that biology company and you find one you like and you trust them and they've got products that work, then please implement a biological program on day one when you start your transition. Here's another good one for your listeners out there. If I would have known this back in the days when I was spraying chemistry, you need to have a humic acid added to every load that goes out on the sprayer. Now, if you are still in a spraying program that's spraying glyphosate, I don't care what you're spraying, you need to have humic acid in there to protect the crop you're going out to spray. I didn't know that. I did not know that when I was still spraying.
Right. Well, yes, the information is pretty readily available for us all to make some darn good decisions.
Yes,
yes. You know, you just mentioned a 300-person audience where you were. So the interest in regen, is it inspiring you as you see more and more people?
Oh, yeah. But I'm always kind of, I kind of look at it as being a realist sometimes. I often wonder what it would be like to be dumped into an audience of non-believers. Because you have to remember, when I'm being asked to come and speak somewhere, these are people that are hungry and are willing to listen to every word I say, take copious notes, and you know, people lined up to ask questions.
Right.
But these are all friendlies. These are all people that are eager to learn. What is a room of 500 conventional type farmers going to do? They're not going to. It's not going to be the same reaction.
But I think you would turn a couple.
You probably could, and
yeah,
that's all that matters.
Right.
Again,
yes,
it's that all or nothing. You've got it. We've got to stop thinking that.
Yeah.
You're right. If
yeah,
you were able to sway four people in that room,
you
that's
know,
a big deal.
Rick, what's your favorite part of your day when you're out farming?
My favorite part of the day is probably, I get a lot of ideas. A lot of them are crazy ideas, but I get a lot of ideas, and it's nice to see something that was implemented to be working. Does it always need to be tweaked and improved? You better believe it. Once you sit back on your laurels and think you've got it all figured out, God will absolutely humble you. There's no end. We have to constantly be looking for something better, something to improve, something to change. That's kind of exciting when you come up with a notion or an idea and you're like, wow, let's go try that, and then it's working.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's probably it. Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful. Well, I watched a little 3-minute-plus video of you guys, and I just loved when your wife said something to the effect of, yeah, you know, when we started cover cropping, we'd have people just coming right up to the house and saying, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I just love that story. It's
yeah,
so nice.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes I feel like we're not very good ambassadors for our community because I've mentioned earlier, we have taken a very radical approach to this of taking everything, I mean everything away. No inputs, no tillage, no nothing. And a lot of our fields by the end of the growing season are getting out of control, weed-wise. And I believe a lot of the neighbors are, you know, I am never going to farm like the way that guy farms because I don't want my fields looking like that. And I understand that now.
Sure.
But I was trying to see how far we could push the system. And now it's going to take a little bit of tillage, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Until we can come up with another idea, it's going to take a little bit of tillage. Now, when you start to look at our fields now and we're managing the weeds better, now they're starting to take notice. Ooh, wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell me more. I think I did a little bit of a disservice there for several years.
No.
That's okay. That's
yes,
okay.
Yeah.
The key here is to show that you can change.
Right.
You can do something different.
Yes. And that takes a pioneer. And that's the spot that you took. And you've certainly been winning award after award for your journey into regenerative farming and for your brave soul to really step out into a no man's land. But I also love that businesses like Land of Lakes and the American Soybean Association are giving out awards for things like this. That was really fun to see.
Yeah, Yeah, it is. It truly is.
So now you know what I'm talking about. Rick Clark has tons of experience and really enjoys sharing that experience to let everyone rise like the boats all at once in the water. For anything we do here, it's cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.